If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body really is? It's true, your biological age, the age of your cells and organs, is actually the number one predictor of your risk for serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, dementia, and more. That's why learning your biological age can be truly life-changing, and that's exactly what the True Age test from True Diagnostic helps you do. With just a simple at-home test, you can uncover your true biological age and get personalized insights to help you take control of your health like never before. No doctor visits, no labs, just a quick finger prick from the comfort of your own home. True Diagnostic doesn't just tell you your biological age, it gives you a personalized report that's full of clear, science-backed steps that you can take to actually slow down aging and improve your health over time. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com. You can use the code JFK to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code JFK at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. So far, in looking at Oswald's enlistment in the Marines, we've covered his initial training tour, his eventful time overseas in Japan and maybe Taiwan, and his return stateside to the Santa Ana base. We also heard Oswald's fellow Marine, David Bucknell, claim that Oswald was recruited into intelligence. We examined Albert Schweitzer College, the tiny, obscure Swiss school where Oswald applied in 1959, and the CIA connections of Percival Brundage, the president of the college's financial arm. In this episode, we'll continue unpacking Oswald's time in the military, with a focus on how Oswald got out of the Marines in September of 1959. We'll also try to get to the bottom of exactly when he began studying Marxism and learning the Russian language.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Lee Harvey Oswald's Marine Corps enlistment contract required him to serve on active duty until December 7th of 1959. This meant that he couldn't just walk away from the Marine Corps. To get out before December 7th, Oswald had to have a special reason. That reason came in the form of a discharge for dependency in order to take care of his disabled mother. But as you will see, there seems to be more to this dependency discharge than meets the eye. In December of 1958, Marguerite Oswald was working for the King Candy Company in a booth inside of the Fair Ridgely department store in Fort Worth. While Marguerite was reaching for a jar, a box of candy fell on her face and nose. She was examined by Dr. Milton Goldberg, who said that she had a small laceration on her nose with swelling, but that the x-rays revealed that there were no fractures. So there was medical confirmation that something had fallen on her, but Marguerite's injury appeared to be only surface level. Not satisfied with Dr. Goldberg's initial diagnosis, Marguerite continued to follow up with him for medical care related to this candy box injury. But Dr. Goldberg told the FBI that he informed Marguerite that, quote, he could not go along with the alleged injury for compensation purposes. So Dr. Goldberg thought that Marguerite was, at a minimum, playing up her injury and making it seem like more than it really was, just so that she could get the insurance money. From February of 1959 until Oswald's discharge was granted, Marguerite saw multiple other doctors on dozens of occasions for various different ailments. None of those doctors found that she was permanently disabled. In August of 1959, her appeal to the Texas Industrial Accident Board from her denial of employment benefits was officially denied. The board found that Marguerite had no loss in wage-earning capacity as a result of the box of candy falling on her nose. Despite the lack of objective evidence for Marguerite Oswald being disabled, Lee Harvey Oswald still sought a discharge for dependency from the Marine Corps for the stated reason of taking care of her, his disabled mother. In July of 1959, Lee Oswald traveled to the Red Cross at the El Toro base and asked them about paperwork for a hardship discharge that would allow him to get out of the Marines early. He told them that his mother was permanently disabled, which, as we have seen, was not true. And at that point, the local Red Cross in Fort Worth was notified so that they could interview Marguerite and determine whether the conditions of a hardship discharge had been met. Patricia Henley from the Fort Worth Red Cross was the one who interviewed Marguerite and told her what documents that she would need for Lee to be able to submit the application. In her written report, Henley described Marguerite Oswald as, quote, neurotic, feeling completely lonely and persecuted. The mother is definitely unstable and in need of support. So the local Red Cross found that Marguerite was disabled, but it wasn't because of a physical ailment. It was because of how she acted in the interview. Henley wasn't aware of all of the medical records or the recent Texas Industrial Accident Board determination, which showed that Marguerite was not disabled. Based on this one visit between Patricia Henley and Marguerite Oswald, the Red Cross then helped Marguerite gather the documentation that was required for Lee to apply to leave the Marines early so that he could come home to take care of her. On August 17th of 1959, once the documents had been compiled, Oswald filed his discharge for dependency application. His request was approved about 2 weeks later at the end of August. That two-week approval timeline was far shorter than the normal amount of time that it took for the Dependency Discharge Board to process applications. Board member Lieutenant Colonel Bolish Kozak, who signed off on Oswald's discharge, told the House Select Committee on Assassinations that it normally took 3 to 6 months for a dependency discharge to be processed. He didn't elaborate on why Oswald's particular case was processed so fast. Perhaps Oswald just got lucky. Oswald served his last day in the Marines on September 11, 1959. About a year later, the Marine Corps would update Oswald's status from a discharge for dependency to an undesirable discharge once they learned about his attempted defection to Russia. Most Warren Report defenders and critics agree that Oswald's discharge wasn't really done so that he could help his mother. It was likely a ruse so that Oswald could travel to the Soviet Union, which he was already planning to do. Oswald even told his fellow Marines and his unit at Santa Ana that he was planning to defect to Russia, according to FBI reports. And Oswald's mother told Dr. Goldberg that her son was planning to defect to Russia 9 months before he did. If Marguerite Oswald really needed help, she had another perfectly good son right in her own backyard of Fort Worth, Robert Oswald. Why wouldn't Robert just help out his mom? The dependency discharge papers actually mention Robert Oswald, but they say that he couldn't help his mom because of his marital responsibilities, as if being married relieves you from the human duty to help take care of your mother. Oswald sent his application fee to Albert Schweitzer College on June 19th, but just a few weeks later, he was asking the Red Cross how to get a dependency discharge for his mother for an injury that he had known about for more than 7 months, since December of 1958. Of course, Oswald can't attend college in Switzerland and care for his mom at the same time in Fort Worth. So why would he waste today's equivalent of $250 on a college application for a school that he knew he couldn't attend because he'd be taking care of his mom? The answer is that he never intended to take care of his mother at all. Just like he never intended to go to Albert Schweitzer College. The discharge for dependency got him out of active duty with the Marines early, and the Albert Schweitzer application allowed him to travel internationally when he otherwise would have been prohibited from travel because of his 3-year inactive duty service obligation. Given that Marguerite's injury was either fake or extremely exaggerated, the question is whether she pushed this idea of being injured by a candy box so that she could help Lee get out of military service early, or whether it was just for money. Either answer is possible, but Grace Craner, Marguerite's landlord, said that on September 13th, Marguerite told her that she wanted her to meet Lee because he was only going to be in town for a few days. Marguerite's knowledge that Lee would not be staying to help her, which was the entire point of the dependency discharge, makes it more likely that she was trying to help Lee commit fraud on the Marines so that he could go to Russia sooner. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick 5-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. When reading about the Warren Report's version of Lee Harvey Oswald, a central part of his persona is the idea that he was stridently dedicated to Marxism, a political philosophy where workers owned the means of production, and communism, a system of government based on Marxist principles. But when exactly did Oswald begin to express these Marxist beliefs? And did he outwardly share those beliefs with anyone else? Oswald told journalist Aline Mosby that he had been interested in communist theory since he was 15 years old when an old lady in New York handed him a pamphlet about saving the Rosenbergs. Oswald turned 14 years old in the fall of 1953 when he and his mother were still living in New York. The Rosenbergs, who were convicted of spying for the Soviet Union, were executed in June of 1953, so what Oswald is saying could be true. We know from looking at Oswald's childhood that the first time anyone who knew him says that he was interested in Marxism is when Henry Timmer, the guy who claims to have met Oswald as a boy in North Dakota, brings it up. But as we've discussed, the Oswald in North Dakota saga is disputed and uncertain. Curiously, Ed Vobel, Oswald's closest friend at Beauregard Junior High School, said that he never mentioned communism. Vobel told the Warren Commission, quote, "I have read things about Lee having developed ideas as to Marxism and communism way back when he was a child, but I believe that's a lot of baloney. I am sure he had no interest in those things at that time, at least that I know of." The next person to say that Oswald discussed Marxism was Palmer McBride, who worked with him at the Pfisterer Dental Lab. McBride is the one who gave the FBI report claiming to have worked with Oswald from December of 1957 through May of 1958. McBride told the FBI, quote, "Lee Oswald was very serious about the virtues of communism and discussed these virtues at every opportunity." McBride also knew Oswald when he got kicked out of William Wolfe's house for talking too positively about communism. Putting North Dakota aside for now, it looks like Oswald started to outwardly share his affinity for Marxism during his friendship with Palmer McBride. To figure out when this was, we're back to the problem of Palmer McBride's time with Oswald at the Pfisterer Dental Lab overlapping with the dates when Oswald was serving in Atsugi, Japan. Richard Garrett, Oswald's 10th grade Arlington Heights high school classmate, told Life magazine that Oswald tried to sell him on communism. This makes sense because right after Oswald dropped out of Arlington Heights high school, he wrote a letter to the Socialist Party of America on October 3rd of 1956. The letter said, quote, Dear sirs, I am 16 years of age and would like more information about your youth league. I would like to know if there is a branch in my area, how to join, etc. I am a Marxist and have been studying socialist principles for well over 15 months. 15 months before the date of this letter would have been the summer of 1955, when Oswald was serving in the Civil Air Patrol alongside Ed Vogel, who says that Oswald never discussed Marxism. Robert Oswald, who was briefly home with Lee some during the summer of 1955, said that if Lee was deeply interested in Marxism, he said nothing about it to me. I didn't see any books on it in the apartment. Between the letter to the Socialist Party and the statements he was making to Richard Garrett, Oswald's outward Marxism really seems to have taken off when he was in Fort Worth right before he enlisted in the Marines. But it's hard to say because Oswald didn't have many close friends during his childhood. After he joined the Marines and was regularly in close proximity to others, those Marines who got to know him had mixed statements on whether Oswald ever favorably discussed communism. Alan Feld, who was with Oswald for several months at boot camp and Camp Pendleton, said that he continually discussed politics and that Oswald was left-winged. Now, this makes sense because just before he joined the Marines, he was writing letters to the Socialist Party. But what doesn't make any sense is that there are entire tours of duty and dates of service where Marines who served with Oswald say that Oswald was no fan of communism, he didn't read about it, and he never even brought it up. During the three-week trip to Japan on the USS Bexar, Daniel Powers, who already knew Oswald from Biloxi, spent a lot of time with him and taught Oswald how to play chess. He said that Oswald would always read books, but not communist ones. He saw Oswald reading Walt Whitman. Aside from Powers, Donald Camerata was the only other person the Warren Commission or FBI spoke with who was with Oswald in both Jacksonville and Biloxi. Camerata had no recollection of any remarks from Oswald concerning communism, Russia, or Cuba. Other Marines who knew Oswald from the USS Bexar and his time at the Atsugi base agreed that Oswald did not show any interest in Russia or communism. John Heindel said that Oswald would go his own way when they were allowed to leave the base, and that he never seemed to be interested in politics or international affairs. Godfrey Daniels says that while the USS Bexar was traveling from San Diego to Japan, he taught Oswald how to play poker. He didn't mention anything about Oswald discussing Russia or communism. Oswald's bunkmates in Atsugi would have spent the most time around him in close quarters. Robert Ogg was one of those bunkmates. He told the FBI that Oswald was quiet, neat, and clean, and that he would always go on liberty alone. None of the other three Marines who shared Oswald's bunk area were interviewed by the FBI or the Warren Commission. In total, the FBI interviewed only 8 people who knew Oswald while he served overseas on his Japan deployment. Many of those Marines didn't even personally know Oswald. The fact that there are 0 witnesses from Oswald's time in Jacksonville, Biloxi, or Japan who recall him speaking favorably of Marxism is somewhat mysterious, especially when we look at the statements from the Marines who served with Oswald at Santa Ana once he returned from Japan. When Oswald was back stateside, he bunked with Nelson Delgado, who said that Oswald always praised the socialist form of government and said that Castro was the best thing that ever happened to the Western Hemisphere. Delgado said that Oswald had a copy of Das Kapital, the same book that Henry Timmer and Palmer McBride mentioned, and that Oswald was always reading it. Sergeant Richard Call echoed what Nelson Delgado said. Oswald had also discussed communism, and specifically the book Das Kapital, with him. Now, by this time, Oswald's love of the Soviet Union was on full display. Everyone in his unit was calling him Oswaldskevich, and it's easy to see why. He played Russian records loudly. When he played chess, he used a set with red pieces to represent the Red Army. And he talked about wanting to help Castro in the Cuban Revolution. Oswald even received a Russian newspaper called The Worker, which he had sent to the Santa Ana Marine Corps base. He told Nelson Delgado that the paper was okay because it was a white Russian paper, not a communist one. Quick Russian history sidebar. White Russians were the faction in Russia that opposed the Bolsheviks. They were the anti-communists. Anyway, this Russian newspaper eventually came to the attention of Captain Robert Bloch, who then confronted Oswald about it. But according to Oswald, he was, quote, merely trying to indoctrinate himself in the enemy's philosophy, which was consistent with the Marine Corps policy. The matter of Oswald's Russian newspaper was then dropped. Jim Batelho, who roomed with Oswald in Santa Ana, told Mark Lane, quote, I'm very conservative. Oswald was not a communist or a Marxist. If he was, I would have taken violent action against him, and so would many of the Marines in the unit. In summary, the first mention of socialism is Henry Timmer when Oswald was 14, but no one else says that Oswald talks about socialism or Marxism until Richard Garrett, when Oswald is about to turn 17. Why wouldn't Oswald talk about his favorite subject for those 3 years in between? Maybe he did, and no one was interviewed who heard him. Or maybe Timmer's North Dakota incident was fabricated, and the first person to actually hear Oswald mention Marxism was Richard Garrett at Arlington Heights. Now, the absence of any Marxist talk for large chunks of Oswald's military career doesn't make any sense, especially when he picked right back up with it when he arrived in Santa Ana. Are we to believe that Oswald decided it wasn't a good idea to talk about communism in Jacksonville, Biloxi, or Japan, but that it was fine for him to do in Camp Pendleton and Santa Ana? It's also strange that Oswald would be espousing the virtues of communism while eagerly leaving high school early to join the Marines. Remember, Oswald tried to enlist in the Marines right when he turned 16 and he was denied. Is that the behavior of a Russia-loving commie? I can't make it make sense. The official answers to that question are that Oswald had a brother in the Marines and that he wanted to get away from his mother. But there's no evidence that Lee and Robert were ever very close, and Lee could have gone anywhere to escape his mom. He didn't need to join the Marines. One last thing on Oswald's relationship with Marxism. We know from Commission Exhibit 2718 that Oswald's love of all things Russian while serving in the Marines did not result in any investigations or negative notes about Oswald in his Marine Corps file. But we're talking about 1959 here. This is just a few years after Joseph McCarthy led hearings on the House Un-American Activities Committee, which accused hundreds of Americans of being communist sympathizers with little proof. Yet, it is just a few years after this that Oswaldskovich is allowed to go full Russian fanboy while on a Marine Corps base. I suppose it could have been a very laid-back and accepting Marine base, but it seems more likely that Oswald was allowed to steep himself in Russian culture because it was part of his job, which is basically what he said when he was asked about his subscription to the Russian newspaper. We just talked about a timeline for Oswald outwardly espousing the political theory of Marxism. But when exactly did he begin to study the Russian language? Now, Russian is not an easy language to learn. It's listed as a Category 4 language, which takes about 1,100 hours to learn, according to the United States State Department. While there is evidence that Oswald was talking about Marxism just before he turned 17, the record is lacking when it comes to any proof on when Oswald first began to learn the Russian language. The Warren Report says, quote, "While in Atsugi, Japan, Oswald studied the Russian language, perhaps with some help from an officer in his unit who was interested in Russian and used to talk about it with Oswald occasionally." The report doesn't tell us who this officer was, and there are no known FBI reports or statements from any witnesses on the topic. So it appears that the Warren Report determined that Oswald first learned Russian in Japan without any evidentiary support whatsoever. Zach Stout was stationed with Oswald in Atsugi. Out of all the Marines in Stout's group who were there in Japan with Oswald, none of them said that he ever spoke Russian. When asked by John Armstrong about the idea of Oswald speaking Russian in Atsugi, Stout said, quote, "That's ridiculous. I never saw or heard him study any foreign language in Japan or anywhere else. Most of the time, we were aboard ship or on maneuvers in the Philippines. He didn't have time to study any foreign language." It also doesn't seem likely that Oswald had a pre-existing knowledge of Russian before Japan. Daniel Powers, who was Oswald's superior officer in radar school and spent a lot of time with Oswald on the USS Bexar, says that Oswald never said anything about Russian, and he never saw Oswald studying or reading Russian. The first evidence that we have of Oswald knowing how to speak Russian or pursuing learning Russian is when Oswald returned from Japan to Santa Ana in December of 1958. Only 2 months later, on February 25th, 1959, Oswald took the Defense Language Proficiency Test, which he passed, getting two more questions correct than he got wrong. This raises the question of how it could be possible that a high school dropout with a ninth grade education level who had never studied Russian before could pass a Russian test with only 2 months of study under his belt. Nevertheless, Oswald did speak, read, and write Russian when he was at the Santa Ana base in 1959. This was a matter of common knowledge among all the Marines who were there at the time, according to the Warren Commission affidavit of Irwin Lewis, who worked with Oswald there in Santa Ana. In the spring of 1959, a few months after passing the Russian test, Oswald was introduced to Rosaline Quinn, the aunt of Oswald's fellow Marine, Henry Roussel Jr. Quinn, who was an airline stewardess at the time, was studying the Russian language because she wanted to work for the State Department in Moscow. She gave her nephew a ride from Louisiana across the country to Santa Ana, California, and ended up staying at a house nearby for about a week. Quinn's nephew, Roussel Jr., set up the date between Quinn and Oswald so that they could practice speaking Russian to one another. They went to dinner and a movie, and Quinn said that while it was hard to talk to Oswald because he was very quiet, he spoke excellent Russian for someone who was self-taught. Now, given that there's no evidence that Oswald learned Russian in Atsugi or before, there has to be something more than meets the eye when it comes to how he picked up the Russian language. I don't know what it is, but you don't go from zero to passing a Russian language test in just a few months of studying. Next time on Solving JFK, I'll be joined for another recap and rebuttals episode by Jeff Crudell, host of the podcast JFK, The Enduring Secret. Jeff and I will unpack all of the disputed issues from Oswald's time in the Marines. And after that, we start looking at Oswald's time in Russia. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information. I'm just